Hello and welcome to edition 421 of the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Edwards, and Marcus Ippi.
On this week's show, we'll be meeting choreographer Trajal Harrell, whose new show at London's Barbican, Hoochie Coochie, is combining art, dance and everything in between.
We'll also be going back to prehistoric times when you were still in short trousers, Marcus, to learn about paleo art. That's pictures of dinosaurs to you and me. We'll hear from writer Zoe Lascars about her new book, Paleo Art, Visions of the Prehistoric Past.
And we'll get a preview of the Edinburgh International Festival kicking off this week from the festival's director, Fergus Linehan.
Plus, Monocle's Bill Lutie will be here to kick off the news agenda for next week, probably, but we'll definitely play a tune or two too. That's all coming up right here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24.
So, Tom, great to be in the studio with you again. I'm quite looking forward to that interview indeed on paleo art. I would imagine you have some vague memories of that era as well.
In the dim and distant past. I understand that you once followed the paleo diet. It was very voguish recently. Lots of red meat, living like some sort of fur-clad caveman.
Actually, I didn't do paleo diet. I once just tried to fast for 10 days with...
10 days?
I fasted for 10 days, only drank juices for 10 days. And you know what that does to you?
I dread to think.
You can't think of anything else than food, really. So what I would do is to go to department stores and grocery stores and just look at what kind of different types of rice they have.
Oh, what a sad picture that paints. There is plenty to look forward to in the programme today. We're going to be talking about contemporary dance, Marcus, a little later. But as I understand it, in your youth, back home in Silinjorvi, near Kuopio, you were no stranger to a bit of the old contemporary dance.
Coincidentally, Kuopio, which is the closest bigger place from my hometown, they do an annual modern dance festival. So I used to go there.
How did you get involved? Throw a few shapes in there? And
I went there, and it's actually... It's interesting. I don't say that I would know much about dance. Obviously, I'm a great dancer myself. But anyway, when it comes to seeing that dance, I don't think I always understood everything that was going on over there. But it was nevertheless very interesting to see what you can actually do when you are a great performer and great artist.
Well, we've got a great artist and performer joining us as well on the programme later.
And also one more highlight, Edinburgh Festival, International Festival. It's one of the highlights, what happens.
It's a cultural...
In Scotland.
Yeah, I don't even know how to... It's a cultural hub. It's a positively luminous event up there in Scotland. So, yeah, we're privileged to have the festival's director, Fergus Linehan, who was actually talking to our culture editor, appropriately enough, Robert Bound. We'll hear what Fergus had to say a little later. We should, Marcus, on with the show. Shall we bring in our own...
Bill Lutie.
...cultural luminary?
Yes, it's time for Bill.
Which way you going, Billy? Can I go too? Which way you going, Billy? Can I go with you?
So, welcome to Midori House Studio One, Bill. What does next week's news have in store for us?
Going to start with a birthday. I don't think we normally do birthdays, but this one's very important. Friday is Barack Obama's birthday. Do you remember him?
Vaguely. Do you remember?
He's been having a lot of fun. He's not the only sort of, I don't know what you'd call them, activist, icon, inspiration to have a birthday on Friday.
Who else has got one?
No, actually, I can't think of anyone. No, I joke. It's our producer, Tom Hall's birthday.
He's probably listening, but what are you going
to
get him?
What do you reckon,
he
by the way?
He seldom listens to
what do you reckon, by the way, if you contrast the way Barack Obama may celebrate his birthday and the way how Tom Hall may celebrate his birthday, do you think they share many things?
They'll probably be quite similar, won't they? They're quite low-key men, but thoughtful. That's how I see them.
Lots of booze, a few dancing girls. I don't know, to be honest. Probably best if we move on. How old's Barack?
He's going to be 56.
See, I mean, he's still a young man, isn't
quite
he?
Quite young, actually. Younger than you, Tom.
He's achieved so much. How proud he must be. Mm. I wonder, though, will there be an air, will he be tinged with, not sorrow the right word, will he look to the White House and just think, Christ?
Well, lots of people are saying, where are you? Is it not time to speak up? You know,
he's
with all of this stuff.
Wide berth, isn't he, at the moment?
But what I'm thinking is that actually considering how young he is, it's actually quite amazing that he's turning 56 now and he can look at the White House and be like, that was an all right thing to do, like for the halfway part of my career.
True.
Halfway through his life, nailed that one. What's next?
Like, I'll leave it to the insane
sexagenarian. What's next? A Christmas
take
single.
Up the mantle. That would be good. That's Barack Obama sell, and exactly. Tom Hall together at last on their 56th birthday.
Singing We Are the World.
Haunting falsetto from Tom Hall over the top.
Anyway, shall we move on? What else should we know about this coming week?
Well, I know that you're going to be talking to the director of the Edinburgh Fringe Festival, but it gives a good opportunity for me to dig up gremlins of the past and tell my Edinburgh Fringe story, which I like to do every year. And I remember actually, Tom, when I started about 4.5 years ago, sitting in the pub, we'd had quite a few beers. You don't normally come to the pub as much anymore, but I must have got a little bit drunk and told you this one.
But I wasn't there.
Yeah, so I'll do it again. And for the lucky listeners, I had a girlfriend for about 4 years. I travelled up to Edinburgh. She was staying there.
That was a special...
I was going to stay with her for the week and visit lots of comedy shows. So I hadn't seen her in about a month because she'd been up. I travelled all the way there on the megabus. It was really awful.
Oh, that's grim already.
Yeah, it was quite grim. Arrived, was texting, "Hey, where are you? Where are you?" She wasn't responding that quickly. I thought, oh, maybe, you know, it's busy or whatever. Finally managed to meet up with her in a bar. And she was like, should we just go outside? And I was like, yeah, cool. Because I haven't seen you in so long. It'd be so nice to just, you know, be you and me. And she sat me down on the curb and said, I don't think we should be going out.
Oh.
It's not funny.
Anymore.
On the curb as well.
On the curb in Cowgate. And then I was like, okay, well, so I looked at like how much it would cost to get back. And I'd spent all my money getting there. And I booked one on the way home, but it was going to be like a 200 quid, 150 quid to get home. So I just had to stay in Edinburgh and I slept at the foot of her bed for a week.
Like some sort of horrible nightmare dog.
Yeah, it's pretty bad.
But you know what? I think we all have gone through something like that, probably. Like something like that may have happened to Tom Edwards as well during the paleo era.
Still letting... clinging on to that one, like a dinosaur with a bone.
Moving on to this coming week's news, what else?
Oh, yeah, that's why we're here, I just remembered. Today, this is so good for us. It's International Friendship Day.
Oh.
Why is that good for us?
Oh. And which sounds kind of, I mean, you know.
What is it for? I mean, like, someone has created that, so how are you meant to celebrate
someone,
this?
Only the UN have created this. This is, like, UN-backed.
Well, wouldn't the United Nations suggest that we should be friends every day, Bill?
Well, exactly. Maybe today is the day that we can kick it off. You know, it's like the new, like a New Year's resolution. You should be doing that throughout the year, but you need a day to remember, to reset. Look at who's in the room, Marcus Hippie, Tom Hall, Tom Edwards, and say, Tom, you're shaking your head.
No.
I just don't want to sound too cynical. I'm just wondering about this then. You know, so you have had probably some UN officials... I don't know, maybe like, I wonder what kind of hippies they've been in 1960s and 70s when they've been like, okay, I want to make the world a better place. We need a special day to celebrate friendship.
It does seem fairly naive coming from the UN, doesn't it?
I just wonder, did that panel, whenever they were convened and whenever this was designed, I imagine they probably had something more pressing they should have been doing.
Right, probably.
If you think of the
something
pressing
Cold
global,
War related, for example.
Global questions, precisely.
Was there ever a dip, maybe in the early 90s? Berlin Wall's just come down. We're looking ahead to something else.
Maybe they were just overwhelmed with images of Hasselhoff and Scorpions playing.
Well, anyway, Bill, how are you going to be celebrating this day with your friends?
Well, I'm going to go...
To Edinburgh and reach out to friends old and new.
No, I probably won't be going back to Edinburgh Fringe. I will be going, I wish, to Montana. More specifically, Rock Creek Lodge, where it's the annual Testicle Festival.
What happens there?
Only 3,000 people descend
come
on this.
Come join together to celebrate testicles.
Yeah, they do, basically. It's,
is that by the UN as well?
It's, I'm not sure if Antonio Guterres is going to be there. He might be making a... Maybe they've invited Donald Trump to do one of his famous speeches.
He's probably been there before.
It's a five-day festival happens? Described as the party you will never remember.
This is quite a good example of what kind of a silly season it is right now. Not much major news.
The politicians are going on holiday. They've got Theresa May's off on her jaunt around Europe.
Donald Trump's taking an 18-day vacation.
He deserves it.
And he's only going to New Jersey.
Right. So the travel time is pretty low. That's good.
Exactly.
Saving money
it's
on
not
that.
Wasting time that way. But it is silly season. Or, of course, as silly season is known in Finland, Marcus.
Mätäkuu, you can say. But
which literally means...
It stands for past month, and there is a historical reason for that, because July is the warmest month in Finland, so obviously, when on the old days, people just noticed that when they had scars and stuff, like, you know, the heat wasn't good for that. But well, anyway, let's move
wherever
on.
Wherever you are in the world, if you've managed to keep your lunch down during this kickoff to the weekly, you're doing better than me. Bill Lutie, I suppose I should technically say thank you, even though I don't feel that way.
You're welcome.
We'll see you next time.
Drajal Harrell is an American dancer and choreographer whose work has appeared everywhere from MoMA in New York to the Barbican in London.
And it's that latter venue where his current show, Hoochie Coochie, named after the risque early 20th century cabaret performances of the same name, takes place until the 13th of August. It's a collection of 14 different styles that see dancers taking over the Barbican's gallery space, almost like moving works of art.
And Drajal joins us now to tell us where art and dance meet. Welcome to the Monocle Weekly.
Thank you very much.
So I guess first we'd like to hear you explain in your own words this performance. What does the audience see there?
Well, the big thing they see is a survey of my work from 1999 to 2016. So it's really the development of a body of work, and there are lots of different developments that happened during those 17 years. And as you said, the main thing is the latest body of work of mine, which is looking at the Hoochie Coochie, which was a dance form, which was kind of a bastardized form of people who saw Eastern dancers who came to Europe and to the United States, and then they kind of bastardized those styles and started doing other things in rural settings. And my father actually went to the Hoochie Coochie show.
I mean, I just wanted to ask more about then what the gallery visitors see. They see a performance exhibition. No. Are they seeing performance art? People are obviously always keen to talk about categorizations. Is that important to you, or do you just kind of get on with the work?
It's a little bit important to me. I mean, I make dances, but I think the dances that I make are quite informed by the history of art and the visual arts, and a lot of my work has been supported by visual art institutions. So it does border some of the work, some performance art, but you see at any moment you go into the galleries, there are at least three performances happening at any time. There are twice a day, there's only one performance happening. That's a very big performance. But most of the time you can see several things happening that are short performances. And yeah, you may think some of them are dance, you may think some of them are performance art. It borders on both of those disciplines, I think.
What is the creative process like, for example, Hoochie Coochie now? Where did you get the inspiration from and how did you start creating it?
Well, I got the inspiration from the fact that my father, when I was a young boy, took me to the fair every year. I grew up in a small town in Southeast Georgia in the United States, and he would take me to the fair, and at a certain point in the night, he would get rid of me and he would go see the Hoochie Coochie show. And as I got older, I started to realize that he was going to see naked ladies dance, but we never talked about it and never asked. So my inspiration was trying to imagine what my father actually saw. So I always try to work in the imagination. So I did some research, but it's really about taking that research and trying to be inspired by the imagination and how things get constructed by our imaginations.
And on that notion of inspiration, it's quite arresting actually with this show. And you mentioned already, obviously, it's a retrospective, so there's quite a wide breadth of material. But we see all different global dance forms, theatre from around the world. Clearly, your influences are multifaceted. How do you sort of build on that inspiration? Is it about traveling frequently, just talking to people? How do you, because it's quite striking that the range of influences, there's sort of Japanese dance, some very austere and quite still pieces. It's an extraordinary range.
I mean, I think at any one point in my work, I'm always focused on one particular research. And now my particular research is in Japan, which also has included a lot of trips to India and South Korea. Part of it is travel. Part of it is, as you say, talking to people, reading, whatever. But I think that the thing that distinguishes my work from a lot of fusion work, because there is dance work where people go and they learn things and they kind of like knit things together. But I don't do that. I kind of find things that inspire me. I let them kind of seep into my system. And then I work in the imagination. I see what comes out. I try to let it flow, we could say.
As Tom mentioned, this is kind of a retrospective of your work from the very late 1990s. You know, as you've been doing that research, learning more about the world, has that changed your relationship with your early work?
Yes. I mean, I think that I see that I was very unfocused.
What do you mean by that?
I mean, you can see the through line from this first piece that I made in 1999. I mean, I made a kind of, at that point, I was really interested in the relationship between the voguing dance tradition and early postmodern dance. And I made a little piece in which I just was very conceptual at the time, in which I just walked, posed, and gazed. So it was a kind of, I kind of took voguing and put it through the filter of minimalism. And then you see my latest work in the exhibit, which is called In the Mood for Frankie. And it's very elaborated, but you can see that basically what I've done is elaborated on the idea that runway movement could be dance language. And you see that in the very beginning in 1999, and you can trace the steps of how I tried to think through that and how to create strategies to make that into a kind of theatrical operation or a theatrical experience. And finally, in the last piece, there's a certain kind of confidence in that that is true. And I think that you see me questioning that maybe in the first piece in 1999. And then you get to 2016, and the way I deal with it is a kind of fact that I feel that I've proven through the years.
I'm interested in this because there is this, you're talking about your inspirations and this idea of filtering things through in the creative process, but also being quite instinctive. And I think people who certainly head to the Barbican and watch this breadth of work will get that feeling that to expect the unexpected. How difficult is it to ensure that people are surprised, or at least, well, no, I suppose it's the same thing, or don't know what to expect? How do you make sure that that happens?
I mean, that comes from years of working in theater and working on the work. And you know that you have to work with rhythm. You know you have to work with people's expectations. And you always have to, like, as soon as they think they've gotten it, you have to change the script. A lot of that is timing and trying to understand the timing. I mean, exhibition is a very interesting form because things are happening in the same time and space. And you can't necessarily determine the route that the viewer goes, but you still can make certain islands or certain platforms in which you know that they will have access or they will hear certain things that will tip them off that something is happening in a certain place. And I have to say, a lot of it is trial and error. Every day I'm trying to refine the exhibition. So we keep working on it every day.
And just on that point, for yourself and the other performers, it's interesting that there's obviously a very different engagement with the audience.
Yeah.
Certainly in a space like these Barbican galleries, it can be very immediate. It's quite literally in people's faces. How different is that from a theatre setting or other more sort of staged settings? And does the work change because of that engagement with the audience?
One of the biggest changes you have is that the audience, I mean, the viewer has the choice to determine its own mobility, where it wants to go, when it wants to go. I mean, I think that that goes back to some of the work I've been doing in the last 3 years. I had a residency at MoMA, and part of what I was working on was trying to think about sculpture in space, how it relates to the theater work I was doing and the gallery work. And so thinking about what it means when you see the body in three-dimensional space, like much closer to yourself, you see it like a three-dimensional sculpture. How to create to make that experience very immediate and vivid for the viewer. So there are a lot of different things I employ, from platforms to piano stools. There are a lot of different strategies I use to enhance the viewer's experience so that they're aware that they can approach this kind of physical experience in the way that they may would approach a sculptural experience in a museum. But I have to say, one of the things I learned from that residency is that I wasn't quite sure when I started off if people would take the clues. But one thing I discovered is that most people who go to theaters also go to museums, and most people who go to museums also go to theaters. So people are a lot smarter than you think they are.
Are you sure?
So what do you hope for from the audience? Then what kind of a reaction do you want to create?
You know, I'm always hoping that I have this idea of feeling thoughts and thinking feelings. I hope that the work is smart and that it engages people's minds, but I also hope it gets into something quite emotional, and that in between those two things, there's a lot of pleasure. I want the experience to be pleasurable for people so that the very thoughtful things don't bombard you in a way that make you feel like, oh my God, this is too much for me. And at the same time, the feeling stuff makes you feel comfortable enough that you can kind of feel things on a deep level. So I try to work in all of those ranges of thinking, feeling, sensing.
It's interesting. We talk about how your work's evolved and how your approach has changed over, what, best part of 20 years or so working in this space. How reactive are you and your creative processes, if at all, to bigger picture issues? I mean, think in the States right now, you look politically, it's a bit of a strange climate. Does it influence your creative processes? I mean, does your work, if maybe it wasn't explicitly or even implicitly political before, does it take on a political dimension because of the bigger context, or do you try and sort of shy away from that?
You know, I think everything can ignore, you can ignore the politics, but I try to stay very focused on what the work is trying to achieve and what it's trying to generate. And I think if you stay very close to that and you keep your eyes open, I mean, I'm an artist, so I'm always involved in the world. I read the newspaper. Like, I may not be commenting on something now, but it may turn out that in 5 years or 3 years, those things will end up in a piece. But I mean, I really feel that as an artist, I need distance from things. And I'm not a politician. I'm not a judge. I'm not a lawyer. I'm an artist. So the thing that I try to get most involved with is the imagination. And my thing is really trying to get people to believe in the impossible. And I think that, if anything, that's where my work relates today, because I think a lot of the things that have happened in politics lately are about things which we thought were impossible. Mm. But if we'd looked closer, maybe they were possible. So I think that that's where my work kind of hooks into that, is that we always have to be looking around the corner at the impossible.
And then on a different note, these performances to take place only on Thursdays to Sundays, I presume that's part of it because you need to get some rest as well.
Yeah, for sure.
So what's the best way, the most optimal way of actually relaxing after these performances?
Yeah, the best way is just, I try to be horizontal for as long as possible, because being vertical takes a lot of energy. So I try to stay off my feet and I try to sleep as much as possible. But as I was saying before, I like to binge on TV, on my computer. I really love to do that and kind of zone out.
And you can enjoy some pretty extraordinary escapism in the company of Trajal and his friends. Hoochie Coochie is at London's Barbican Centre until the 13th of August. But for those wanting to hear more in person, can attend Trajal in conversation at the Barbican on Wednesday, I think. Wednesday the 2nd
Wednesday
of
the
August
2nd.
At 7 p.m. So head along. Trajal, thanks for coming to see us, and good luck with the rest of the performances.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me.
Buckle up, put the armrest down and slide away that table. The third edition of The Escapist, Monocle's annual travel-focused journal, has landed. Our editors and bureau chiefs offer you their take on those far-flung places where opportunity and great design find a home. We head to Semmering in Austria, a sleeping architectural beauty being gently awoken by an ambitious set of hospitality entrepreneurs. Then we take a drive down Turkey's liberal west coast and dust up on Broome's long history of welcoming new arrivals to Western Australia. Also, our culture editor, Rob Bound, sifts the treasure from the trash in Benidorm. We also reveal the winner of Monocle's third annual restaurant awards, as well as a crop of comfy new hotels in which to rest your head. The Escapist is your summer set piece, packed with the sunniest and smartest insights from leaders in the travel industry. The Escapist, on newsstands now.
Every Sunday, the Bulletin with UBS goes behind the numbers and the hype to explain what's really happening in the world of finance. Brought to you from the desks of the key analysts at UBS and experts from around the world, the programme delivers definitive insights into the people, places and products set to shape the week ahead. This is the show that explains how a fast-moving financial world really works. Set your agenda for the week ahead. Tune in to The Bulletin with UBS every Sunday at 1600 London time. Anytime after that, you can download from monocle.com and via iTunes or SoundCloud. The Bulletin with UBS on Monocle 24.
Marcus, you ready for for a tune, bit of music?
I've been waiting for that for quite a few minutes already, yes.
Okay, well, let's enjoy something from New York City. This is Samantha Abani with Hints and Implications.
So So, Tom, that was Samantha Obani there with Hints and Implications. You're listening to the Monocle Weekly.
How do Europe's business leaders start their day?
Everyone's seeing the possibility of what reforms could do to unleash the power of the Indian economy is really exciting.
Who tracks the stories that really matter like no one else?
You're going to take so much money out of the Greek economy that they can't possibly generate growth. You have to manage a transition to a more private-oriented economy.
Where can you have a real conversation to kickstart your working day?
You don't mean the referendum on gay marriage, do you?
I don't. Which is coming up. Surprising.
Very interesting. And the International New York Times has a piece. They assume that it will be passed. Mm-hmm.
The answer to all these questions is The Globalist on Monocle 24. Weekdays at 7 a.m. in London.
Summer is officially here, and so is Monocle's bumper July-August double issue. Here we celebrate quality of life and reveal this year's rundown of the top 25 cities to live in worldwide. We also meet the people striving to make life in their cities better, from the mayor of Los Angeles to the sunny team that looks after Tokyo's parks and gardens, to the urban heroes giving back to their hometowns. Meanwhile, in design, we cast our gaze up to the rooftops in Milan and find a hidden and surprisingly verdant world above the fray. And of course, we've always got room for a bit of pure hedonism as we dance the night away in Tel Aviv, unwind in Finland's most inviting and steamiest company retreats, and tuck into some sun-kissed beach food in Valencia. And speaking of sun-kissed, we also sit down with Mario Testino for his hypothetical last meal. That's all in the July-August issue of Monocle, on newsstands everywhere now. Or head to monocle.com to become a subscriber.
This is the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Edwards, and Marcus Hippie. Now, dinosaurs, Marcus, are, of course, very old things, but our perception of how they look is a relatively new one. Artists' renditions of how they might have appeared only became popular during the 19th century. And seeing as we'll never be quite sure of a Triceratops' skin tone or a T-Rex's scales, these renditions have got pretty creative over the years.
Now, Tashin has collected some of the most striking examples of those works known as paleo art and compiled them into the book Paleo Art Visions of the Prehistoric Past. Its authors are Zoe Lescars and Walton Ford. And a little earlier, Zoe joined Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco to tell him more.
Dinosaurs, they're everywhere, but it's hard to remember sometimes that this is a fairly recent genre. Prior to 1830, there were no pictures of prehistoric animals, and it was only then that people started to imagine what these reptiles and other creatures may have looked like and what their world may have looked like. It started then because that was around the time that scientists in London and continental Europe were first discovering prehistoric reptiles and identifying them as such. I mean, people have been finding dinosaur bones for hundreds of years or millennia, and they had previously thought these might be the bones of dragons or of giants. And it was in 1796 that the French anatomist Georges Cuvier took one look at some mammoth bones, and he was a brilliant scientist who you could hand him the wing of a fruit bat and he could tell you exactly which species it was. And so he looked at the bones of some mammoths from Siberia and realized that these were not elephants as many people thought they were because they look so similar. He realized, no, these are a species that no longer exists. They're so big. If they existed, we'd see them around. And so that's when extinction started to catch on. It was a real process, though. And that's another important thing to remember and to grapple with as we look at these images. We're so used now to thinking of global warming and species extinction and climate change that it's hard to remember that people living in the 19th century thought every animal that was on Earth had been created on the same day and would be around forever, and that humans would be around forever. So the concept of extinction itself was extremely threatening. And I think the threat and the fear and the uncertainty posed by that concept makes its way into the earliest works of paleo art. So you'll see some images at the beginning of the book where there are these really monstrous animals fighting tooth and claw and mauling each other underwater. Everyone is bleeding. Everyone is biting one another. Everyone's chasing one another. And it's a real frenzy. And that was sort of one aspect of the beginning of paleo art. And there are other images that are more Edenic and peaceful. The genre is interesting to me because it is so various. There's just so many artistic visions contained within it.
I think some of them, like noticing in the book, I mean, there are a lot of kind of dinosaurs fighting in a way, which of course makes it for a good image. But I mean, of course, they want to try to make it as real as possible. But they were creating certain situations that perhaps wouldn't be real. So it's kind of they were being quite playful as well, don't you think?
Yes, definitely. Whether intentionally or not, a paleo art is a vehicle for artists and whole society's fears and fantasies. I think that because no one has ever seen a prehistoric animal, fossils become blank slates upon which we can project some of our wildest, most imaginative ideas. And many of the artists working in this genre, if not all of them, were working very seriously with sober scientific intentions. They were looking very carefully at the fossil evidence and trying to reconstruct the creature and trying to reconstruct the creature's environment. But nonetheless, these fantastical elements made their way in there anyway. And a great example of that is the violence you see in some of these images. I mean, there are volcanoes going off in the background. There are bolts of lightning streaking through these tumultuous, cloudy skies. It's incredibly dramatic and theatrical. And I think that that's one of the sort of interesting parts of paleo art, that while it's created in a scientific realm, it's also created to entertain in a way. I mean, you rarely see a work of paleo art where the dinosaur's back is turned, or where it's hidden behind some leaves or sleeping or dead or, you know, just sort of sitting around. I mean, these are scientific images that have a lot of subjective narrative, a lot of whimsy and fantasy in them as well.
And Zoe, is paleo art something that is still kind of going strong these days?
It changed immensely even in the first decades after the genre took off in 1830. Every artist brought different ideas to the table. And again, that's what makes the genre so interesting to me. You have not only these different visions of prehistory as either nightmarish or peaceful, but you also have different artistic styles. If someone was influenced by, say, French Impressionism, as this one American artist, Charles Knight, was, he might paint prehistory in the style of the French Impressionists. So if Claude Monet is painting haystacks with golden light and purple shadows, you then see velociraptors with purple shadows and golden light, and while other artists are bringing their own sensibilities to it. So paleo art really changed from artist to artist to artist all throughout the years. It continues on today. The book I wrote cuts off more or less around 1990. And that's because as an art historian, I'm sort of most interested in the earlier years of the genre, when there was the most room for the artist's imagination, when there was less scientific evidence available, and when there was less technology at the disposal of artists and scientists to reconstruct these animals. It's still an enormously creative process, creating works of paleo art. I mean, still, we don't know so many things about how these creatures looked. And while we're slowly finding bits of fossil evidence that indicate what color a certain animal might have been, little bits of preserved pigment, or learning that many species had feathers, we still have so many more technologies now. You know, you have DNA analysis and computer modeling and stress tests that show you that, oh, if there's these sort of wear patterns on a thigh bone, then the animal must have stood like this, it must have ran like that, and then the artist has that much more information. But when the first artists were making these images, there was no existing idea, no set sort of precedent that they could model their images afterwards. And that, to me, is really an interesting moment, this process of invention.
Zoe Lascars there in conversation with Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco. And Paleo Art, Visions of the Prehistoric Past, is out now. This is the Monocle Weekly. Now, as we were hearing earlier in the programme, the Edinburgh International Festival kicks off this Friday and will run in the city until the end of August.
Earlier, Monocle's culture editor Robert Bound was joined by the festival's director, Fergus Linehan, to learn what we should be looking forward to.
Fergus, thank you so much for joining us from Edinburgh, which obviously shows you're a busy man, which is good for all of us. I've always wondered, what do you do at the beginning of a festival year? Do you really start with a kind of blank sheet of paper and fill it in? Or do you have things bustling to the front of your mind that you want to program into the festival each year?
It depends on the art form. So everything, it's like kind of trains leaving stations. So things like opera programming has to be done 2 to 3 years out, orchestral programming about 2 years out, and then you get right up against it where you've things like popular music or casting actors is done right up against it. So in fact, we're still kind of casting a few little things right up to the days before. So yeah, we kind of have these parallel programming schedules depending on the way the art forms work.
So we kind of think of you waking up feverishly at 3 a.m. with a flash of inspiration going, we'll get so-and-so to work with so-and-so and it's going to be amazing. But actually, a lot of it is it's timetabling. As you said, it's a little bit like running a railway as much as a big creative institution and festival.
People who are really good have got multiple options all the time. They're always oversubscribed. So there's always a moment where they're kind of going, oh, which one will we do? You know, so there's a lot of kind of flirtation in programming. Everyone's incredibly enthusiastic a couple of years out. And then as it gets nearer and nearer, it's kind of reality time. And so you're constantly having those conversations. And, you know, somebody might be saying, oh, I'd love to do that if that director's involved. Or a director might be saying, I'd like to do that if that actor's involved. So it's kind of chess in 3D.
So you're doing a bit of batting your eyelashes. You've got some great names from pop music, Benjamin Clementine to Bryn Terfel doing the Valkyrie and PJ Harvey as well this year. This is the thing, presumably finding a balance. I mean, I've biased, so I've turned to music right there. What about putting people together, doing a bit of kind of cultural speed dating? As you said, this singer will do it if this director is going to be involved and all the rest of it. Do most of those things kind of come off?
Some of them come off, or some of them don't come off the year you think they're going to come off. So sometimes something completely falls apart and then just suddenly resurrects itself 2 years later. And sometimes, you know, you basically just have to say, we're constantly ready. You know, we're always ready. There's, you know, I mean, I worked at the Sydney Opera House. There was, you know, there were bands there who you just constantly rang every year. And then occasionally someone would go, you know, we should do that. And they go, who are those guys who are always ringing us, asking us to do it? So those kind of things, they can be, it can either be a sort of, you know, we are going to do this on the 15th of August in 2019, or it can be as ephemeral as just, you know, whenever you want, we're here and ready for you. And then there's sometimes projects which you just kind of put together because, you know, they don't exist in any form. So there's a very important Edinburgh band called the Incredible String Band, who are part of the whole psychedelic folk music. And Joe Boyd, who is their producer, is coming back because they really were a huge influence on things like Led Zeppelin and the Beatles and right through to kind of all the new folkies like Fleet Foxes. So, but to go and revisit that requires pulling all sorts of people together who don't necessarily work together. So it's a combination of things which you actually shape and trying to just persuade people to do maybe what they're doing already.
And you mentioned the Incredible String Band there. This is the kind of thing that I'm sure a lot of other big names great and small, in fact, on your roster of artists and list of performances would like to see, would like to be part of, would like to admit informed their practice in the way that they make their art. Is this part of it as well, that you book one person and then maybe, you know, three more people turn up and they go, oh, I want to do so-and-so. I want to do a Q&A with that person. I want to work with that person. I've always wanted to get that person's phone number. Presumably there is a bit of collegiate booking happens, does it?
There is a bit of collegiate booking, and I think also people are interested if you are doing more than just, you know, booking what happens to be rolling through. So, you know, you mentioned Valkyrie, which you're doing, which is, you know, 5 hours of Wagner. It's a huge undertaking. But trying to put a cast together like that is a huge effort. That's not something that exists. And I think that artists appreciate it when an organization or a festival is doing something which is kind of enhancing or enriching the scene, you know. So those sort of projects I think are really important for the festival to be seen as more than just, you know, a booker of existing works. And that goes across everything, that goes into dance and theatre and everything else as well.
And when you're giving someone the hard sell or maybe the soft sell what are you telling people are the draws of performing in Edinburgh? It's obviously a sophisticated place with a great kind of homegrown audience. I know you obviously pull an audience from the rest of the world as well. But what's your what are your, in Edinburgh's USPs, I wonder?
I think what you get is people like to be in the context of sometimes there's people who are just, you know, PJ Harvey's a good example, kind of, you know, highly theatricalized shows, wanders from literature to kind of theater through to music and film and everything else. So people who are kind of, you know, have that breadth of reach like to be in a multi-genre arts festival. Some people like the fact that it's just, it's fun, you know, there's a lot of dates when you're touring are not fun. And to suddenly be in the middle of all of that. For a lot of people, it's being around kind of all their peers. It's a moment where everyone involved in the sort of entertainment industry, really, beyond the arts, is kind of here, whether it's for the TV festival or the book festival or whatever else. And it's just a great meeting place. So it's a kind of a, there are certain types of people who really like that kind of festival environment. And there are people who don't.
And, I mean, are you kind of thinking that people get a ticket for various things? I mean, obviously, you can buy a ticket to all sorts of different things. Are you hoping that people see the poster for something on their way out of something else and book their next thing? The idea of kind of a bit of cross-pollination, if someone wants to go and see, you're celebrating Paul Auster's 70th birthday, great thing. Are you hoping that people who maybe aren't very familiar with someone like Benjamin Clementine might kind of hear a whisper around the auditorium and out of curiosity book some tickets to go and see him play?
Yeah, and you get that. That is very Edinburgh. I mean, everywhere else I've ever worked, you know, you're talking to a fairly dedicated audience. So many people arrive up to Edinburgh having booked for nothing and, you know, come up the hill and go, just try to get a sense of what's good and what's on tonight. There's a huge amount of ticket sales are done in that way. So you do get people going to kind of the most unlikely things. And as you say, you might get someone going to a Benjamin Clementine show who've never even heard of him. And that's very interesting. It's a little bit terrifying as well, because it means you don't do most of your business in advance. So you're waiting. But it also kind of creates a sort of meritocracy where if something's really good, the word goes out incredibly fast. And, you know, within 24 hours, it can sell out, as opposed to, you know, something's really good and it's not getting noticed.
Well, there is that idea. I mean, it is a festival. It happens over a lot of days. It's so multidisciplinary. But there is that idea when you're at a music festival, for example, that you essentially hear the music wafting from the other stage and you think, wow, I love this. And you go and wander over. There is a bit of that, presumably, a bit of serendipity and happenstance. And as you say, just there are some tickets left for things.
Yeah, there is. I mean, but people generally expect there to be tickets left for things. It's not like there are other festivals where, you know, if you're not booked up and ready to go 3 months in advance, you're not getting in. So, you know, it isn't that sort of a festival. I think Edinburgh in August is more, you can actually come up and just sort of put your ear to the ground and hustle your way into things. So it's kind of, it's exciting in that way.
And as we said at the beginning, you know, we've got opera, theatre, classical music, contemporary music, so many different things under the umbrella that you're holding up there, Fergus. If you could put a sort of dream team together, whoever on lead vocals, whoever directing them, etc., out of this year's amazing mismatch of people, or match up in heaven of people, I should say, the dream team, who would you like to see work together in the most unlikely circumstances?
In popular music, we all just want to get Tom Waits on the road again. That's kind of, you know, that's just what we do. On stage, I would like Cate Blanchett, I think, is the greatest actor of our generation. Where in classical music, probably the pianist Martha Argerich, or probably Martha Argerich. In dance, probably Paris Opera Ballet. So, yeah, you could put all those together, I'd be happy.
All bossed around by a certain Fergus Linehan. Thank you very much for joining us. I know you're going to have a fantastic festival. Our best wishes to you, and thank you very much for your time today.
Edinburgh International Festival Director Fergus Linehan there, speaking to Monocle's Rob Bound. We recommend you make your way to Edinburgh over the coming weeks to check out all the city has to offer. There we are, Marcus. A pleasure to spend my Sunday lunchtime with you. Another Monocle Weekly bites the dust. And once more, it was a show that had pretty much everything from dinosaurs like yourself to
that's an old
to contemporary dance to Bill Luty to, I don't know, everything in between.
Exactly. It's always amazing how much you can learn from your presenter mate when you're doing this program. For example, I didn't know how knowledgeable you were when it comes to modern dance. And I bet you didn't know about my dance history either.
Very interesting. And I think we've all agreed that we'll be heading to Kuopio, near to Silmioli.
Actually, Kuopio is a place that does have a great modern dance festival every year, every July, I reckon. So maybe see you there in 2018.
Exactly. I'm off to book my ticket.
I have all the top tips for that town of 80,000 people.
Perfect. Well, before our audience head off to buy their own tickets and research more about Silinjorvi and Kuopio, in fact, we should bid them farewell. But first, thank the team behind this week's programme. Edition 421 of the Monocle Weekly was produced by Tom Hall, and our studio manager was Cassie Galpin.
The Monocle Weekly will be back again next week, but for now, it's goodbye from me, Markus Hippi.
And from me, Tom Edwards.
Goodbye.